Part 2. Non ignara mali miseris succurrere disco. No stranger to trouble myself, I am learning to care for the unhappy. Virgil, Aeneid, Book 1. Chapter 1. With all the gallons of newsprint and hours of televised talk that have been poured forth on the subject of Lula Landry's death, rarely has the question been asked, why do we care? She was beautiful, of course, and beautiful girls have been helping to shift newspapers ever since Dana Gibson cross-hatched lazy-lidded sirens for the New Yorker. She was black, too, or rather, a delicious shade of café au lait, and this, we were constantly told, represented progression within an industry concerned merely with surfaces. I am dubious. Could it not be that, this season, café au lait was the in shade? Have we seen a sudden influx of black women into the industry in Landry's wake? Have our notions of female beauty been revolutionised by her success? Are black Barbies now outselling white? The family and friends of the flesh and blood Landry will be distraught, of course, and have my profound sympathy. We, however, the reading, watching public, have no personal grief to justify our excesses. Young women die every day in tragic, which is to say, unnatural circumstances. In car crashes, from overdoses, and occasionally because they attempted to starve themselves into conformity with the body shape sported by Landry and her ilk. Do we spare any of these dead girls more than a passing thought as we turn the page and obscure their ordinary faces? Robden paused to take a sip of coffee and clear her throat. So far, so sanctimonious, muttered Strike. He was sitting at the end of Robin's desk, pasting photographs into an open folder, numbering each one, and writing a description of the subject of each in an index at the back. Robin continued where she had left off, reading from her computer monitor. Our disproportionate interest, even grief, bears examination. Right up until the moment that Landry took her fatal dive, it is a fair bet that tens of thousands of women would have changed places with her. Sobbing young girls lay flowers beneath the balcony of Landry's 4.5 million penthouse flat after her crushed body was cleared away. Has even one aspiring model been deterred in her pursuit of tabloid fame by the rise and brutal fall of Lula Landry?
Get on with it, says Drake. Her, not you, he added hastily. It's a woman writing, right?
Yes, Melanie Tilford, said Robin, scrolling back to the top of the screen to reveal the headshot of a jowly middle-aged blonde. Do you want me to skip the rest? No, no, keep going. Robin cleared her throat once more and continued. The answer, surely, is no. That's the bit about aspiring models being deterred. Yeah, got that. Right, well. 100 years after Emmeline Pankhurst, a generation of pubescent females seeks nothing better than to be reduced to the status of a cut-out paper doll, a flat avatar whose fictionalized adventures mask such disturbance and distress that she threw herself from the third-story window. Appearance is all. The designer Guy Sommet was quick to inform the press that she jumped wearing one of his dresses, which sold out in the 24 hours after her death. What better advert could there be than that Lula Landry chose to meet her maker in Sommet? No, it is not the young woman whose loss we bemoan, for she was no more real to the most of us than the Gibson girls who dripped from Dana's pen. What we mourn is the physical image flickering across a multitude of red tops and celeb mags, an image that sold us clothes and handbags and a notion of celebrity that, in her demise, proved to be empty and transient as a soap bubble. What we actually miss, were we honest enough to admit it, are the entertaining antics of that paper-thin good-time girl whose stripped cartoon existence of drug abuse, riotous living, fancy clothes and dangerous on-off boyfriend we can no longer enjoy. Landry's funeral was covered as lavishly as any celebrity wedding in the tawdry magazines who feed on the famous, and his publishers will surely mourn her demise longer than most. We were permitted glimpses of fairy celebrities in tears, but her family were given the tiniest picture of all. They were a surprisingly unphotogenic lot, you see. Yet the account of one mourner genuinely touched me. In response to the inquiry of a man who she may not have realised was a reporter, she revealed that she had met Landry at a treatment facility and that they had become friends. She had taken her place in a rear pew to say farewell and slipped as quietly away again. She has not sold her story, unlike so many others who consorted with Landry in life. It may tell us something touching about the real Lula Landry, that she inspired genuine affection in an ordinary girl. As for the rest of us, doesn't she give this ordinary girl from the treatment facility a name? Interrupted Strike. Robin scanned the story silently. Nope. Strike scratched his imperfectly shaven chin. Bristol didn't mention any friend from a treatment facility. Do you think she could be important? Asked Robin eagerly, turning in her swivel chair to look at him. Could be interesting to talk to someone who knew Landry from therapy instead of nightclubs. Strike had only asked Robin to look up Landry's connections on the internet because he had nothing else for her to do. She had already telephoned Derek Wilson, the security guard, and arranged a meeting with Strike on Friday morning at the Phoenix Cafe in Brixton. The day's post had comprised two circulars and a final demand. There had been no calls, and she had already organised everything in the office that could be alphabetized, stacked, or arranged according to type and colour. Inspired by her Google proficiency of the previous day, therefore, he had set her this fairly pointless task. For the past hour or so, she had been reading out odd snippets and articles about Landry and her associates, while Strike put into order a stack of receipts, telephone bills, and photographs relating to his only other current case. "Shall I see whether I can find out more about that other girl, then?" asked Robin. "Yeah," said Strike absently, examining a photograph of a stocky, balding man in a suit and a very ripe-looking redhead in tight jeans. The besuited man was Mr. Geoffrey Hook. The redhead, however, bore no resemblance to Mrs. Hook, who, prior to Bristow's arrival in this office, had been Strike's only client. Strike stuck the photograph into Mrs. Hook's file and labelled it number 12, while Robin returned back to the computer. For a few moments there was silence, except for the flick of photographs and the tapping of Robin's short nails against the keys. The door to the inner office behind Strike was closed to conceal the camp bed and other signs of habitation, and the air was heavy with the scent of artificial limes, due to Strike's liberal use of cheap air freshener before Robin had arrived. Lest she perceive any tinge of sexual interest in his decision to sit at the other end of her desk, he had pretended not to notice her engagement ring for the first had pretended to notice her engagement ring for the first time before sitting down, then made polite, studiously impersonal conversation about her fiancé for 5 minutes. He learned that he was a newly qualified accountant called Matthew, that it was to live with Matthew that Robin had moved to London from Yorkshire the previous month, and that the temping was a stopgap measure before finding a permanent job. "Do you think she could be in one of these pictures?" Robin asked after a while. "The girl from the treatment centre." She had brought up a screen full of identically sized photographs, each showing one or more people dressed in dark clothes, all heading from left to right, making for the funeral. Crash barriers and the blurred faces of crowd formed the backdrop to each picture. Most striking of all was a picture of a very tall, pale girl with golden hair drawn back into a ponytail, on whose head was perched a confection of black net and feathers. Strike recognised her, because everyone knew who she was. Kira Porter, the model with whom Lula had spent much of her last day on Earth, the friend with whom Landry had been photographed for one of the most famous shots of her career. Porter looked beautiful and somber as she walked towards Lula's funeral service. She seemed to have attended alone, because there was no disembodied hand supporting her thin arm or resting on her long back. Next to Porter's picture was that of a couple captioned film producer Freddie Bastigui and wife Tansy. Bastigui was built like a bull, with short legs, a broad barrel chest, and a thick neck. His hair was grey and brush cut, his face a crumpled mass of folds, bags, and moles, out of which his fleshy nose protruded like a tumour. Nevertheless, he cut an imposing figure in his expensive black overcoat, with his skeletal young wife on his arm. Almost nothing could be discerned of Tansy's true appearance, behind the upturned fur of her coat collar and the enormous round sunglasses. Last in this top row of photographs was Guy Sommet, fashion designer. He was a thin black man who was wearing a midnight blue frock coat of exaggerated cut. His face was bowed and his expression indiscernible due to the way the light fell on his dark head, though three large diamond earrings in the lobe facing the camera had caught the flashes and glittered like stars. Like Porter, he appeared to have arrived unaccompanied, although a small group of mourners, unworthy of their own legends, had been captured within the frame of his picture. Strike drew his chair nearer to the screen, though still keeping more than an arm's length between himself and Robin. One of the unidentified faces, half severed by the edge of the picture, was John Bristow, recognisable by the short upper lip and the hamsterish teeth. He had his arm around a stricken-looking older woman with white hair. Her face was gaunt and ghastly, the nakedness of her grief touching. Behind this pair was a tall, haughty-looking man who gave the impression of deploring the surroundings in which he found himself. "I can't see anyone who might be this ordinary girl," said Robin, moving the screen down to scrutinise more pictures of famous and beautiful people looking sad and serious. "Oh, look, Evan Duffield." He was dressed in a black t-shirt, black jeans, and a military-style black overcoat. His hair, too, was black, his face all sharp planes and hollows. Icy blue eyes stared directly into the camera lens. Though taller than both of them, he looked fragile compared to the companions flanking him. A large man in a suit, and an anxious-looking older woman, whose mouth was open and who was making a gesture as though to clear a path ahead of them. The threesome reminded Strike of parents steering a sick child away from a party. Strike noticed that, in spite of Duffield's air of disorientation and distress, he had made a good job of applying his eyeliner. "Look at those flowers!" Duffield slid up to the top of the screen and vanished. Robin had paused on the photograph of an enormous wreath in the shape of what Strike took initially to be a heart, before realising that it represented two curved angel wings composed of white roses. An inset photograph showed a close-up of the attached card. "Rest in peace, Angel Luna, D.B. Mack," Robin read aloud. "D.B. Mack? The rapper? So they knew each other, did they?" "No, I don't think so. But there was that whole thing about him renting a flat in her building. She'd been mentioned in a couple of his songs, hadn't she? The press were all excited about him staying there. You're well informed on the subject." "Oh, you know, just magazines," said Robin vaguely, scrolling back through the funeral photographs. "What kind of name is D.B.?" Strike wondered aloud. "It comes from his initials. It's D.B., really," she enunciated clearly. "His real name's Daryl Brandon MacDonald." "A rap fan, are you?" "No," said Robin, still intent on the screen. "I just remember things like that." She clicked off the images she was perusing and began tapping away on the keyboard again. Strike returned to his photographs. The next showed Mr. Geoffrey Hook kissing his ginger-haired companion, hand palpating one large, canvas-covered buttock outside Ealing Broadway tube station. "Here's a bit of film on YouTube, look," said Robin. "D.B. Mack talking about Lula after she died." "Let's see it," said Strike, rolling his chair forwards a couple of feet, and then, on second thoughts, back one. The grainy little video, 3 inches by 4, jerked into life. A large black man wearing some kind of hooded top with a fist picked out in studs on the chest sat on a black leather chair facing an unseen interviewer. His hair was closely shaven and he wore sunglasses. "Lula Landry's suicide?" said the interviewer, who was English. "That was fucked up, man, that was fucked up," replied D.B., running his hand over his smooth head. His voice was soft, deep and hoarse, with the very faintest trace of a lisp. "That's what they do to success. They hunt you down. They tear you down. That's what envy does, my friend. The motherfucking press chased her out that window. Let her rest in peace, I say. She's getting peace right now." "Pretty shocking welcome to London for you," said the interviewer, "with her, you know, like falling past your window." D.B. Mack did not answer at once. He sat very still, staring at the interviewer through his opaque lenses. Then he said, "I wasn't there. Or you got someone who says I was." The interviewer's yelp of nervous, hastily stifled laughter jarred. God, no, not at all, no. D.B. turned his head and addressed someone standing off camera. "Thank God I've brought my lawyers." The interviewer brayed with sycophantic laughter. D.B. looked back at him, still unsmiling. "D.B. Mack," said the breathless interviewer, "thank you very much for your time." An outstretched white hand slid forwards onto the screen. D.B. raised his own in a fist. The white hand reconstituted itself, and they bumped knuckles. Somebody off-screen laughed derisively. The video ended. "The motherfucking press chased her out that window," Strike repeated,
rolling his chair back into its original position. Interesting point of view. He felt his mobile phone vibrate in his trouser pocket and drew it out. The sight of Charlotte's name attached to a new text caused a surge of adrenaline through his body, as though he just sighted a crouching beast of prey. I will be out on Friday morning between 9 and 12 if you want to collect your things.
What?
He had the impression that Robin had just spoken. I said, there's a horrible piece here about her birth mother. Okay, read it out. He slid his mobile back into his pocket. As he bent his large head again over Mrs. Hook's file, his thoughts seemed to reverberate as though a gong had been struck inside his skull. Charlotte was behaving with sinister reasonableness, feigning adult calm. She had taken their endlessly elaborate duel to a new level, never before reached or tested. Now let's do it like grown-ups. Perhaps a knife would plunge between his shoulder blades as he walked to the front door of her flat. Perhaps he would walk into the bedroom to discover her corpse, wrist slit, lying in a puddle of congealing blood, in front of her fireplace. Robin's voice was like the background drone of a vacuum cleaner. With an effort, he refocused his attention. Sold the romantic story of her liaison with a young black man to as many tabloid journalists as they were prepared to pay. There was nothing romantic, however, about Marlene Higson's story, as it is remembered by her old neighbours. She was turning tricks, says Vivian Cranfield, who lived in the flat above Higson's at the time she fell pregnant with Landry. There were men coming in and out of her place every hour of the day and night. She never knew who that baby's father was. It could have been any of them. She never wanted the baby. I can still remember her out in the hall, crying on her own, while her mum was busy with the punter. Tiny little thing in her nappy, hardly walking. Someone must have called social services, and not before time. Best thing that ever happened to that girl, getting adopted. The truth will, no doubt, shock Landry, who has talked at length in the press about her reunion with her long-lost birth mother. This was written, explained Robin, before Lilla died. Yeah, says Strike, closing the folder abruptly. Do you fancy a walk? Chapter 2. The cameras looked like malevolent shoeboxes atop their pole, each with a single, blank, black eye. They pointed in opposite directions, staring the length of Alderbrook Road, which bustled with pedestrians and traffic. Both pavements were crammed with shops, bars and cafes. Double-deckers rumbled up and down bus lanes. This is where Bristol's runner was caught in film, observed Strike, turning his back on Alderbrook Road and to look up the much quieter Bellamy Road, which led, lined with tall and palatial houses, to the residential heart of Mayfair. He passed here 12 minutes after she fell. This would be the quickest route from Kentigern Gardens. Night buses run here. Best bet to pick up a taxi. Not that that would be a smart move if she just murdered a woman. He buried himself again in an extremely battered A to Z. Strike did not seem worried that anyone might mistake him for a tourist. No doubt, thought Robin, it would not matter if they did, given his size. Robin had been asked to do several things in the course of her brief temping career that were outside the terms of a secretarial contract, and had therefore been a little unnerved by Strike's suggestion of a walk. She was pleased, however, to acquit Strike of any flirtatious intent. The long walk to this spot had been conducted in almost total silence, Strike apparently deep in thought, and occasionally consulting his map. Upon their arrival in Alderbrook Road, however, he had said, "If you spot anything, or you think of anything I haven't, tell me, won't you?" This is rather thrilling. Robin prided herself on her observational powers. They were one reason why she had secretly cherished the childhood ambition that the large man beside her was living. She looked intelligently up and down the street, and tried to visualise what someone might have been up to on a snowy night in sub-zero temperatures at 2 a.m. "This way," says Strike, however, before any insights could occur to her, and they walked off, side by side, along Bellamy Road. It curved gently to the left and continued for some 60 houses, which were almost identical, with their glossy black doors, their short railings either side of clean white steps, and their topiary-filled tubs. Here and there were marble lions and brass plaques, giving names and professional credentials. Chandeliers glinted from upper windows, and one door stood open to reveal a checkerboard floor, oil paintings in gold frames, and a Georgian staircase. As he walked, Strike pondered some of the information that Robin had managed to find on the internet that morning. As Drake had suspected, Bristow had not been honest when he asserted that the police had made no effort to trace the runner and his sidekick. Buried in voluminous and rabid press coverage that survived online were appeals for the men to come forward, but they seemed to have yielded no results. Unlike Bristow, Strike did not find any of this suggestive of police incompetence or of a plausible murder suspect left uninvestigated. The sudden sounding of a car alarm around the time that the two men had fled the area suggested a good reason for their reluctance to talk to the police. Moreover, Strike did not know whether Bristow was familiar with varying quality of CCTV footage, but he himself had extensive experience of frustrating, blurry and black and white images from which it was impossible to glean a true likeness. Strike had also noticed that Bristow had not said a word in person or in his notes about the DNA evidence gathered from inside his sister's flat. He strongly suspected, from the fact that the police had been happy to exclude the runner and his friend from further inquiries, that no trace of foreign DNA had been found there. However, Strike knew that the truly deluded would happily discount such trivialities as DNA evidence, citing contamination or conspiracy. They saw what they wanted to see, blind to inconvenient, implacable truth. But the Google searches of the morning had suggested a possible explanation for Bristow's fixation on the runner. His sister had been researching her biological roots and had managed to trace her birth mother, who sounded, even when allowance was made for press sensationalism, an unsavoury character. Doubtless revelations such as those that Robin had found online would have been unpleasant not just for Landry, but for her whole adopted family. Was a part of Bristow's instability, for Strike could not pretend to himself that his client gave the impression of a well-balanced man, that he believed Lula, so fortunate in some ways, had tempted fate, that she had stirred up trouble as trying to plumb the secrets of her origins, that she had woken a demon that had reached out from the distant past and killed her. Was that why a black man in her vicinity so disturbed him? Deeper and deeper into the enclave of the wealthy, Strike and Robin walked, until they arrived at the corner of Kentigern Gardens. Like Bellamy Road, it projected an aura of intimidating, self-contained prosperity. The houses here were high Victorian, red brick with stone dressings and heavy pedimented windows on four floors, with their own small stone balconies. White marble porticos framed each entrance, and three white steps led from the pavement to more glossy black front doors. Everything was expensively well-maintained, clean and regimented. There were only a few cars parked here. A small sign declared that permits were needed for the privilege. No longer set apart by police tape and massing journalists, number 18 had faded back into graceful conformity with its neighbours. "The balcony she fell from was on the top floor," said Strike, "about 40 feet up or so." He contemplated the handsome frontage. The balconies on the top three floors, Robin saw, were shallow, with barely standing room between the balustrade and the long windows. "The thing is," Strike told Roman, while he squinted at the balcony high above them, "pushing someone from that height wouldn't guarantee death." "Oh, but surely," protested Robin, contemplating the awful drop between top balcony and hard road. "You'd be surprised. I spent a month in a bed next to a Welsh bloke who got blown off a building about that height. Smashed his legs and pelvis. Lot of internal bleeding. But he's still with us." Robin glanced at Strike, wondering why he'd been in bed for a month. But the detective was oblivious, now scowling at the front door. "Keypad," he muttered, noting the metal square inset with buttons and a camera over the door. Bristow didn't mention a camera. Could be new. He stood for a few minutes testing theories against the intimidating red brick face of the fantastically expensive fortresses. Why had Lula Landry chosen to live here in the first place? Sedate, traditional, stuffy, Kentigern Gardens was surely the natural domain of a different kind of rich. Russian and Arab oligarchs, corporate giants splitting their time between town and the country estates, wealthy spinsters slowly decaying amidst their art collections. He found it a strange choice of abode for a girl of 23, who ran, according to every story Robin had read out that morning, with a hip, creative crowd, whose celebrated sense of style owed more to the street than the salon. "Looks very well protected, doesn't it?" said Robin. "Yeah, it does. And that's without the crowd of paparazzi who were standing guard over it that night." Strike leaned back against the black railings, number 23, staring at number 18. The windows of Landry's former residence were taller than those on the lower floors, and his balcony, unlike the other two, had not been decorated with topiary shrubs. Strike slipped a packet of cigarettes out of his pocket and offered Robin one. She shook her head, surprised, because she had not seen him smoke in the office. Having lit up and inhaled deeply, he said, with his eyes on the front door, "Bristow thinks someone's got in and out that night, undetected." Robin, who had already decided that the building was impenetrable, thought the strike was about to pour scorn on that theory. But she was wrong. "If they did," says Strike, eyes still on the door, "it was planned, and planned well. Nobody could have got past photographers, a keypad, a security guard, and a closed inner door, and out again, on luck alone. Thing is," he scratched his chin, "that degree of premeditation doesn't fit with such a slapdash murder." Robin found the choice of adjective callous. "Pushing someone over a balcony is a spur of the moment thing," says Strike, as though he had felt her inner voice, her inner wince. "Hot blood, blind temper." He found Robin's company satisfactory and restful, not only because she was hanging off his every word and had not troubled to break his silences, but because that little sapphire ring on her third finger was like a neat full stop. This far and no further. Suited him perfectly. He was free to show off in a very mild way, which was one of the very few pleasures remaining to him. "But what if the killer was already inside?" "That's a lot more plausible," said Strike, and Robin felt very pleased with herself. "And if a killer was already in there, we've got the choice between the security guard himself, one or both of the Pastigues, or some unknown person who was hiding in the building without anyone's knowledge. And if it was either the Pastigues or Wilson, there's no getting in and out problem. All they had to do was return to the places they were supposed to be. There was still the risk that she could have survived, injured, to tell the tale, but a hot-blooded, unpremeditated crime makes a lot more sense if one of them did it. A row and a blind shove." Strike smoked a cigarette and continued to scrutinise the front of the building, in particular the gap between the windows on the first floor and those on the third. He was thinking primarily about Freddie Pastigui, the film producer. According to what Robin had found on the internet, Pastigui had been in bed asleep when Lula Landry toppled over the balcony two floors above. The fact that it was Pastigui's own wife who had sounded the alarm and insisted that the killer was still upstairs while her husband stood beside her implied that she, at least, did not think him guilty. Nevertheless, Freddie Pastigui had been the man in the closest proximity to the dead girl at the time of her death. Laymen, in Strike's experience, were obsessed with motive. Opportunity topped the professionals' list. Unwittingly confirming her civilian status, Robin said, "But why would someone pick the middle of the night to now have an argument with her? Nothing ever came about her not getting on about with her neighbours, did it? And Tansy Pastigui definitely couldn't have done it, could she? Why would she run downstairs and tell the security guard if she'd just pushed Lula over the balcony?" Strike did not answer directly. He seemed to be following his own train of thought, and after a moment or two replied, "Bristow's fixated on the quarter of an hour after her sister went inside, after the photographers had left and the security guard had abandoned the desk because he was ill. That meant that the lobby became briefly navigable. But how was anyone outside the building supposed to know that Wilson had left his post? The front door's not made of glass. Plus," interjected Robin intelligently, "they'd have needed to know the key code to open the front door. People get slack. Unless the security people change it regularly, loads of undesirables could have known that code. Let's have a look down here." They walked in silence right to the end of Kentigern Gardens, where they found a narrow alleyway which ran, at a slightly oblique angle, along the rear of Landry's block of houses. Strike was amused to note that the alley was called Surf's Way. Wide enough to allow a single car to pass, it had plentiful lighting and was devoid of hiding places, with long, high, smooth walls on either side of the cobbled passageway. They came in due course to a pair of large, electrically operated garage doors, with an enormous private sign affixed to the wall beside them, which guarded the entrance to the underground cache of parking spaces for the Kentigern Gardens. When he judged that they were roughly level with the back of number 18, Strike made a leap, caught hold of the top of the wall, and heaved himself up to look at the long row of small, carefully manicured gardens. Between each patch of smooth and well-tended lawn and the house to which it belonged was a shadowy stairwell to the basement level.
Anyone wishing to climb the rear of the house would, in Strike's opinion, require ladders, or a partner to belay him, and some sturdy ropes. He let himself back down the wall, slide back down the wall, emitting a stifled grunt of pain as he landed on the prosthetic leg. "It's nothing," he said, when Robin made a concerned noise. She had noticed the vestige of a limp and wondered whether he had sprained an ankle. Chafing on the end of the stump was not helped by hobbling over the cobbles. It was much harder, given the rigid construction of his false ankle, to navigate uneven surfaces. Strike asked himself ruefully whether he'd really needed to hoist himself up on the wall at all. Robin might be a pretty girl, but she could not hold a candle to the woman he had just left.